this condition produces a very precarious feeling tone. When you are at the apex of being an expert and there's no one to whom you can go, then you have to depend upon the only resource left to you. Because remember now, the world of factual evidence is seen to be illusory. Not just because of sleights of hand, but because of the very nature of the senses, the very nature of the mind, the very nature of understanding phenomena. It's all watery. So that Newton becomes an expert in biblical languages. We find Sir Isaac Newton as being one of the great Greek scholars of his day. When he writes Greek, he writes it with all the aspirations and all the correct forms and so forth, which almost nobody at the time had. When he writes Hebrew, he has all the Masoretic points and everything exactly right. Almost nobody. Newton, therefore, must have forced himself to not only go into the biblical languages, but forced himself to become the expert, again, relying on his mind. It's the only thing he had left. And it is this confidence that one is adrift in the universe with no anchorage, no port, and the only thing you have to go by is the facility of your mind. And so the Enlightenment gets its kick off from Newton in a very real way, from Leibniz also, because the only certainty that man had left was his mind and the hope that the mind would be able to figure out the truth. Now this discovery of the loneliness of man's mind in face of the abysmal wishy-washiness of phenomena was in fact circulating for almost 100 years in the European psyche. As usual, where there is a study necessary to understand the delicate nuances of this kind of comprehension, you usually find major studies written by women rather than men. And in this case, a woman named Marjorie Hope Nicholson, who taught at Columbia about 25 years ago, wrote two wonderful volumes. One of them is called The Breaking of the Circle, The Effects of the New Science Upon 17th Century Poetry. And what is the new science? Newton. And the other one was Newton Demands the Muse, Newton's Optics and the 18th Century Poets. Both these are in paperback. So Marjorie Hope Nicholson wonderfully centers herself in on this problem, the breaking of the circle. And she records in here, page 119 in The Breaking of the Circle, in a chapter called The Death of a World, The Death of a World, Newton was present at the death of the world. He was there at the end of time. He was there at the end of everything that was meaningful. And because he was a biblical scholar, he realized that all the predictions of the apocalypse and everything had come true in his time, only instead of coming true in terms of the phenomenal world, they had come true in terms of man's mental world. And he was present at the apocalypse when man's mind reached the end. And so Newton is a mariner into the vast spaces beyond, fashioning, hopefully, a new methodology to recover some new mind, some new form of understanding. Newton, in this light, I hope you intuit, is a very heroic figure. He, in fact, is exactly that Promethean figure that Shelley would write about in Prometheus Unbound. We'll see in this course how the reaction against Newton finally at the end of the century gets its apotheosis in William Blake, who condemns Newton. He says this is the man who put gears in the face of God and expected us to believe that that was true. But the revolutionary Shelley, who we don't get to in this course, he comes in with Beethoven and Napoleon and all Goethe and all those people in the Romantic Revolution, who didn't despair at this, who sees this and said, this is a torch of freedom. Man must walk alone, therefore we will walk alone. And God will catch up with us if we're worthwhile. That's sort of an attitude. She writes, Marjorie Hope Nicholson writes in Death of World, but what of the star 1572 in Cassiopeia, which was a supernova? And what of the star in 1604 in Serpentarius, which was another supernova? And if you remember, the Rosicrucian Fama Fraternitatis made a big thing out of the new star in 1604. These are universal events. You see, the heavens had been firm. The celestial order had been firm since time immemorial. All of a sudden, there are new stars in heaven. My God, what does this mean? It means that heaven is changeable. It's no longer immutable. She writes, there were new stars, and therefore miracles, and many a believer waited for the second coming of Christ. But to others of the Reformation generation, as pessimistic as Luther, the new stars were rather portents, dire omens of God's wrath against the sinful generation, presages to men that the angels were indeed making ready their armor. Who are the angels going to fight? Not the devils. They've already been cast into the pit. They're going to fight man. He's the real target of the war in heaven. This is serious business. When this involves your belief structure, this is very serious business. God in his justice would not permit the world to run its allotted course of 6,000 years, but would destroy it by flood or fire. The end of the world was at hand. The sound heard in 1610 with the publication of Galileo's Sidereus Nuncius, which was the starry messenger. Galileo's publication on the title page has all sorts of stars drawn in by hand, and in this figure comes in like a comet. It looks just like a comet coming in, starry messenger, news for man. And later on, 200 years later, when Blake is dealing with all this, trying to put it back together, hit one of his favorite figures is the messenger running in with the torch, right? And we still have that figure today of the Olympic torch being carried by the runner. The same figure. The starry messenger, Galileo's publication in 1610, was less Aaron's bell than the first note of Gabriel's trumpet. In more senses than one, Galileo had seen through heaven and had found no heavenly city. There's no heavenly city out there, but instead, stars innumerable, never seen by the human eye, the true nature of the Milky Way, a new moon, possibly a new world in that moon, four new planets, which though they proved not planets but satellites of Jupiter, was as effectual as new planets in destroying not only the old astronomy, but what mattered more to man, the very basis of the old astrology. Ancient philosophers had guessed at another universe than that man had always seen. Copernicus had proposed an hypothesis of another kind of universe, but Galileo had saw it with his own eyes, with a telescope, with a telescope. Now for the first time, a new astronomy, new stars, new planets, a new moon, a new universe came home to man's business and bosoms. Man decays, that had long been a tenet of Christian faith. The world decays. That, too, was orthodox enough. But beyond the orb of the moon, there had been no decay, no change, no alteration. Heaven was secure. It was God's home. Yet the new stars were in the celestial region, and Galileo's telescope had discovered spots on the moon and darker spots on the sun. There was corruption in heaven. My God! we find the young Isaac Newton at the age of 30, when he was admitted to the Royal Society, the first paper that he read was his new invention of an improved telescope. And he says in his declaration to the Royal Society, he says, "I'm surprised that man has gotten as far as he has with these primitive telescopes, ineffectual, like the ones that Galileo was using. Whereas I have a telescope which brings the universe really home to man." So you can imagine this tremendous revolution of Galileo. And here Newton's coming along at the tender age of 30, addressing the Royal Society in his first meeting, saying, "Gentlemen, I have a new telescope that will really do it." Yes. And what he was talking about was that there was a naivete in Galileo. He hadn't gone far enough. He simply took nature at its card face value. He thought light was light. He said, "Friends, light is an amazing complexity which I have unraveled. In fact," he said, "I have unraveled it exactly. Light is composed of a number of rays, and unless you have a very sophisticated second lens to refocus the disparate rays of light back into white light focus, you won't be able to see very clearly out there. Whereas with my telescope refracting, I am now able to carry the eye of man way out." And I find also that there are no gates of the heavenly city out there. In fact, we have a very strange universe on our hands. And the only guide that we have left is man's mind to understand the laws of nature. And these laws are precise, and they admit of no real derivation. Now we come to a very interesting situation. Everyone is walking on eggshells in terms of their feeling structure, in terms of their intellectual security, in terms of their personal idea of freedom. They're all afraid. And they are clinging to the laws of reason as the only guidelines left to man. And this is why you find in the Enlightenment not only the emphasis on reason, but the requirement of personal and social etiquette. Because when everyone's scared to death, everyone is polite as all get out. And this is why in the 18th century you find all this effusion of, "Sir, I am at your service, and you're obedient," and so forth, and all of this excessive politeness is an indication of a deep-seated, massive cultural nightmare they're all embroiled in. The Savior was no longer so much the trusted figure of Jesus, but the hoped-for efficacy of the supermind that hopefully man would be able to reconstruct the world somehow. But in order to do this, he was faced with almost immediately a task. If all this were true, and if he had come to this point, this realization, then what in the world was the true understanding of man's history? What are we? How did we get here? And where are we? And so it was to the next figure that we go who addressed himself to these problems, an Italian named Vico. And just because Vico wrote 300 years ago doesn't make him out of date. James Joyce used Vico in writing Finnegan's Wake and found him to be exceedingly precise about the nature of man's mind and reality and history. And we'll take a look at him next week.